So how do I begin to talk about Shakespeare? I begin, of course, with England. I don't remember a time in my life when I didn't want to go to England. I grew up dreaming of Europe, looking at postcards, reading medieval history, thinking there was something more authentic, older, and probably just simply better about Europe than this new world where I happened to live. When I went to the University of Washington for my bachelor's degree, I had the opportunity to study abroad. At that point, I finally got to go to England. And indeed, I did love everything about living in England as I thought I would. What impressed me most of all during that time is understanding London as a palimpsest. As I walked around the old city, I could see modern-day skyscrapers, but also Victorian or Georgian buildings. You could see medieval remains, and if you looked far enough, you could see a Roman road or a Roman wall. These different layers of history impressed me so much that I particularly fell in love with an American poet who reinvented himself as a British person, that is T.S. Eliot, who also was fascinated by these different layers of history and said toward the end of his epic poem, The Wasteland, "These fragments I have shored against my ruin." I'm quite fond of crypts and skulls. My students will tell you that I'm uncannily fond of skulls. There is, of course, Hamlet's iconic pose, looking at the skull of Yorick, the memento mori, the reminder of death. I don't think of this as something morbid, though. I think of this as a way of reflecting upon our past, of being able to situate ourselves in history. Now, Hamlet is a pretty good play, I have to admit. But during this trip to England, my study abroad experience, undoubtedly my most formative theatrical experience of my life happened, and that was the opportunity to see King Lear by the Royal Shakespeare Company. I sat there in the theater, utterly awed by what I was watching. To this day, I can still remember the horror of watching Gloucester blinded, the agony of Edgar, who has to pretend to be mad in order to stay alive, and the utter despair of King Lear coming in that last scene with his dead daughter in his arms. I believed then, and I still believe, that nothing can equal the power and the energy of theater. To no one's surprise, after my undergraduate career, I decided to go on for an MA and a PhD in English literature. I went to the University of British Columbia, where I specialized in Shakespeare and his contemporaries. By the time I was a professor, I was a specialist specifically in textual editing. People often look at me blankly, textual editing, what's that supposed to mean? Well, in brief, textual editors pay specific attention to the early modern printed book, like this page from the Timon of Athens play that I edited, which you see on the left. I modernized the spelling, the punctuation, regularized things, add stage directions, and basically turn it into a format like you see on the right that modern day readers can read, understand, and access. You'll understand the other thing that we like to add is many, many, many notes at the bottom of the page. So I spent a lot of time writing notes, but also long introductions that take account of various things that have to do with the play. Now, this work as a textual editor brought me to glorious rare books libraries around the world, such as the British Library, the Bodleian Library in Oxford, the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. I love holding old books, those material remains of the past. I find myself touching them, looking in the gutters at the chain lines and the watermarks on the pages. This connection to the material presence of the book, I think, is so important for the immersion in history. And that part of Shakespeare and his contemporaries and my scholarship has always been really, really important. But despite that, I suppose my greatest love has always remained for the theater itself. I am endlessly fascinated how Shakespeare keeps meaning something new in every era, with every iteration, new actors, new designs, and concepts. Shakespeare is always alive and remade. So my work as a dramaturg for Montana Shakespeare in the Parks and my work with some other theatrical companies has given me the opportunity to work with artists and address current issues such as global warming, race, and gender. I love seeing Shakespeare made and remade and relevant to the present. These twin poles of the history and the presentism are the cornerstone of my scholarship and, in fact, of my teaching. Back to England for just one moment, if I can. John of Gaunt in Richard II opines about the beauty and majesty of England, saying, "This royal throne of kings, this sceptered isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden, demi-paradise, this happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in a silver sea." During my sabbatical in 2014, Kevin, Luke, and I had the great privilege of moving to Stratford-upon-Avon. It was like living in a Shakespeare theme park, of course, what with the birthplace and the tourism and all of that. But it also had a fantastic library. The Royal Shakespeare Company was down the street, and I was utterly in heaven. This was also an opportunity to return to our family roots. My father and sister came to visit, and we went to Shropshire to visit the little sheep farming town called Minton. The town of Minton, the name translates to mountain town. One of the appropriate returns in my life that I should end up in the state of Montana, when actually my name stands for a mountain town. But even beyond all the Shakespeare theme park stuff, what really impressed me and made this lasting change in my scholarship, I suppose, when I lived in Stratford, is realizing the importance of that rural landscape that Shakespeare inhabited. Unlike most of his contemporary playwrights, Shakespeare did not grow up in London. Instead, he grew up in this provincial town. So every walk around Stratford that I took, there were rivers, trees, flowers, Shakespeare's deer, all sorts of things that seemed very, very important to the plays. I started reading the plays in different ways and realized how deeply immersed they are in the natural world. In every day of my sabbatical, I kept thinking, what is this importance of place? What place does Shakespeare belong in? Shakespeare, though, is clearly a global phenomenon. Maybe the best way to illustrate this is to think what happened in London in 2012. It was the Olympics year, so the Globe Theatre in London invited companies from around the world to come and perform the entire canon of Shakespeare's 38 plays in different languages and cultures there at the Globe. This is just a smattering that you get a sense of what happened, such as a Maori Troilus and Cressida, an Iraqi Romeo and Juliet, and a Sudanese Cymbeline. Shakespeare has indeed become a global phenomenon, speaking in so many languages and to so many people around the world. Now, I'm often asked, is it true that Shakespeare was the greatest author that ever lived? I honestly don't know, and I don't know that I'm that interested in such a subjective question. What seems to me much more important is that for 400 years, Shakespeare has been talked about, thought about, taught, and performed, and discussed, and argued about. So we have created a Shakespeare, in quotation marks, that is much bigger, more important, and ultimately, I would posit, more interesting than a single individual Will Shakespeare of Stratford could ever have been. When I lived in Stratford, I didn't come to think that everybody has to make a pilgrimage to the birthplace in order to understand the plays. Instead, what I understood is how every intellectual exploration is always embedded in a physical, material landscape. In fact, what it ultimately did is enhanced my desire to understand Shakespeare in terms of where I live and work. So for the past several years, I've been working on this book project about Shakespeare in Montana, a book project that I've had the pleasure to share with Kevin, who first told me that I should pay attention to what mountain men said about Shakespeare. We have managed to travel around and to see all sorts of wonders that I'm going to share with you now. I'm going to talk first about some books that were carried around Montana, and then about some stages on which Shakespeare was performed. There's a HarperCollins book published about a decade ago called State by State, A Panoramic Portrait of America. It has this map, and on the map, on each state, it has an icon epitomizing what each state is known for. So Arizona has a cactus, Iowa has an ear of corn, Kentucky has a racehorse. So what do you suppose is on Montana? Is it a mountain? Is it a cowboy? Fly fisherman? It's actually the face of Shakespeare. Now, how would one explain such a weird phenomenon? The authors of the book say, if there's one thing all Montanans have in common, other than a disdain for speed limits and a thing for huckleberries, it's a love of William Shakespeare. Now, for the authors of this book, the reason for Montana's love of Shakespeare is Montana's Shakespeare in the Parks. And indeed, this makes sense. For 47 years, this amazing company has crisscrossed the state and brought Shakespeare to thousands and tens of thousands of people, even in the most remote corners of the state. If I think of remote corners of the state and Shakespeare in the Parks, I cannot help but think of Poker Jim Butte. Like ABC, PBS, and the New York Times before me, I have gone to Poker Jim Butte to see what happens up there. It's an isolated state park in the southeastern part of the state above a tiny town called Burney. What happens up there, though, really is remarkable. In the middle of nowhere, as if conjured out of nothing, people come up to this butte year after year to witness Shakespeare productions. I love the upper left one, which clearly comes from the 70s, if you could see. I'm fascinated not just by this fact that people come to see Shakespeare, but that there's a formation of community around that. The people share potlucks after the productions, and the actors camp out all night there. Kevin and Luke and I have also camped out there. We cannot resist this need to become part of this story, part of this magical place where Shakespeare appears in this expansive landscape, often while forest fires burn in the distance. But is Shakespeare in the Parks the reason for the popularity of Shakespeare in Montana? It's certainly one of the reasons, but what I've discovered in my research is that Shakespeare in the Parks is not the cause, but the continuation of a long love affair that Montanans have had with Shakespeare. Years of researching this have led me to all sorts of stories about Shakespeare in Montana that are fantastic. It was really difficult for me to decide which of these stories I wanted to share with you tonight. But I'm going to focus on these specific stories that have to do with these books and these stages and the way that they are always embedded in the physical landscape. So first, about those books. It's difficult to find a more appropriate way to think about the Book of Nature than to think of As You Like It, when the exiled Duke Senior from As You Like It talks about the idyllic life in the Forest of Arden. And this our life, exempt from public haunt, finds tongues in trees, books in the running brooks, sermons in stones, and good in everything. For the early white explorers who came to this region, books were rare and thus incredibly important. Anecdotes about wagon trains, mountain men, pioneers all suggest that these people, if they could possibly manage it, were carrying two books: the King James Bible, and the complete works of Shakespeare. The trapper Osborne Russell, Joe Meek, and others gathered together for winters in buffalo skin lodges, reading Shakespeare, discussing, sometimes acting out scenes. This was a gathering that Osborne Russell lovingly termed Rocky Mountain College. I cannot help but notice that this happened in 1834, sadly disproving the president's assertion that Montana State University was the first university in the state. On the topic of mountain men, here we are looking out at the Bridgers. There's this mountain man named Jim Bridger. He was, in fact, illiterate. But by all accounts, he absolutely loved Shakespeare. He learned that Shakespeare was important, so he traded with a wagon train to get his hands on the complete works of Shakespeare. He hired a boy in the camp to read him the stories. Bridger loved Shakespeare, but he was also quite opinionated about what Shakespeare did and didn't write. learning one night that, in fact, the tyrant Richard III had killed the princes in the Tower, Jim Bridger exclaimed, "Shakespeare must have had a bad heart and been as damned mean as a Sioux to have written such scoundrelism as that." He took the book and tossed it into the fire. Now, Bridger also had opinions about that fat knight, Mr. Fullstuff, as he called him. He decided that perhaps Mr. Fullstuff was a little bit too fond of lager beer and thought maybe things would have gone better for him if he had stuck to good old-fashioned bourbon. Now, what I find most interesting about all these stories about Bridger is not Bridger himself, but the fact that so many people wanted to tell these stories. Even in his own time, apparently Bridger's contemporaries found it fascinating that this larger-than-life, colorful, illiterate mountain man liked Shakespeare so much and wanted to make Shakespeare his own. One contemporary wrote, "It was amusing to hear Bridger quote Shakespeare. He could give quotation after quotation and was always ready to do so. Sometimes he seasoned them with a broad oath so ingeniously inserted as to make it appear to the listener that Shakespeare himself had used the same language." So Bridger carried this physical book, and then he wanted to make it his own. This legend illustrates a fundamental point. Explorers in the Rockies came out here seeking wealth and opportunity, but they also, in some sense, wanted to own Shakespeare, not just for the wisdom and the poetry of his stories, but because they were interested in incorporating Shakespeare, and this is the Shakespeare in quotation marks, into their own formations of Western American identity. This Shakespeare was an endlessly adaptable concept that could mean anything that these people needed it to at any given moment. The value of the Shakespearean book is exemplified quite nicely by the story of Granville Stewart and his brother James, some of the earliest white permanent settlers to Montana. Granville tells a story of one winter in which he and James found themselves famished for something to read. They were living in the Deer Lodge area, and they heard that there was a man in the Bitterroot trading for books. So even despite the inclement weather, James and Granville saddled up their horses, they made this perilous journey, crossed rivers, all that sorts of things, and they went to the book trader and they bought 5 books at $5 apiece, including an illustrated copy of Shakespeare. They were completely out of money at that time, but as Granville said, "We had the blessed books, which we packed carefully in our blankets and joyfully started on our return ride home of 150 miles. In the days before newspapers and when paper itself was actually scarce, mining town residents likewise were very anxious to get their hands on books of any kind. In Virginia City, the schoolmaster Thomas Dimmesdale in the 1860s was busy penning what would be the first printed book in Montana, The Vigilantes of Montana. This Englishman, Dimmesdale, was very interested in how Shakespeare could provide moral framework for the lawless society that he saw in Virginia City. So he begins nearly every epigraph of The Vigilantes with a quotation from Shakespeare. Meanwhile, Dimmesdale had a young student named Mary Sheehan, who was a self-styled girl from the gulches. She played hooky a lot and ran around dredging out sluice boxes and that sort of thing. But when she talked in her memoirs about what it was like to grow up in mining towns, she said her parents always revered Shakespeare, and they placed the complete works of Shakespeare on a table in the center of their living room on a fancy tablecloth lit by a kerosene lamp. This was a sort of altar to learning. One of the really exciting finds that Kevin and I made one day in the Virginia City archives was this book in the middle. They claim there that they didn't have any Shakespeare books and they didn't suppose any survived. So they took us back into the archives and I pulled this off the shelf, an 1802 edition of Shakespeare. And we said, "What's this?" And they said, "Oh, I guess we do have this." It's wonderful to see that this survived and to know that people in Virginia City in the 19th century would have been reading this book. Yet we shouldn't assume from people like the schoolmaster or even the altar to learning that Mary Sheehan's family had that Shakespeare was always about pretensions of education or class or social status. Cowboys, for instance, seem to care quite little for that. Yet, by all accounts, cowboys, too, loved to read Shakespeare. In fact, one tobacco manufacturer marketed in their tobacco pouches little mail-in forms where the cowboys could mail in for cheap paperback editions of Shakespeare. This is the way to increase the sales, not of Shakespeare, but of the tobacco. One person named John Ashton Rollins reported that there was a ranch near Livingston, and women who visited always wanted to read novels. The cowboys, though, he said, alone attacked Shakespeare. They devoured the stories. They couldn't stop talking about how wonderful Shakespeare was. One cowboy, responding to the dogs of war speech in Julius Caesar, said, "Gosh, that fellow Shakespeare could sure spill the real stuff. He's the only poet I ever saw what was fed on raw meat." Another story is about cowboys who won't come in to dinner. The cook complains that he keeps calling grub time and the cowboys aren't coming to dinner because they're busy reading Shakespeare. The cook is incensed. So, in retaliation, he takes the books and throws them in the Yellowstone River. This is an amusing story that ends with the wry joke that this was, in fact, Montana's first circulating library. These stories all point to the value, the price, and the excitement of the Shakespearean book, and the lengths to which people would go to acquire them. What were people looking for? Was it poetry, wisdom, good stories? Perhaps a combination of all of these. But one thing that remains true throughout these 19th century accounts, and that's that these readers certainly didn't think of Shakespeare as a museum piece, something old from England that no longer mattered to them. Instead, Shakespeare was ultimately adaptable, transmutable to the environment. And Shakespeare changed with every saddlebag, with every river, with every fire. This was equally true for the women who read Shakespeare in the late 19th and early 20th century. By the 1890s, they were forming women's clubs, reading Shakespeare, discussing, recording everything in minutes books and annual programs. Sometimes these annual programs were beautifully printed with watercolor portraits sewn together. Later on, in Butte, the West Side Shakespeare Club decided to be appropriate to where they were from and do a copper-covered program. These physical memorials of the kind of reading these women were doing is echoed by what they sought from the texts of Shakespeare. They were particularly interested in Shakespeare's heroines. Characters such as Portia and Beatrice in particular became models for these women, many of whom were involved in the various early days, in the earliest days of the women's suffrage movement. Meanwhile, women in the Dillon Shakespeare Club amassed quite an impressive library. This was not just the works of Shakespeare, but history books, things about the life and times of Shakespeare, and the existing criticism at the time. They helped to raise money to build the Dillon Public Library and housed all of these books there as a community repository that really symbolized, I think, the domestication of Shakespeare. It had gone, Montana had gone from being a frontier to a territory to a territory to a town. Now it was time for Shakespeare to be domesticated? Anyway, part of the domestic, let's say that. When we think of the settling of the West, it is, of course, easy to be a little bit nostalgic, thinking about a time when things were a little bit more wild. One period I think about, if we want to pinpoint something that seems overtamed, might be the 1950s and 60s in Yellowstone National Park, when those bears wandered around all too tame, standing up on their hind legs and begging for food. As it turns out, the poets Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath took a trip to Yellowstone National Park in 1959. Ted Hughes wrote a poem about a bear who was much more savage than he expected, who broke into their car and stole their food. The poem reads in part, "He'd leaned in and claw hooks lifted out our larder. He'd left matted hairs, I glued them in my Shakespeare. That was our 59th bear. I saw well enough the peril that seesaws opposite a curious impulse. What slight flicker in a beast's brain electrifies tonnage and turns life to paper. Gluing a piece of bear's fur into a copy of Shakespeare, what better example could there be of the Western landscape encroaching on a Shakespearean story? The tongues and trees in the Forest of Arden remind us that in order to have our books at all, we require the raw materials that come from those trees. But even when the wild might be settled, we may find ourselves pursued, as Shakespeare said in his most famous stage direction, by a bear. Taking a piece of that bear and providing a palimpsest, as Hughes does, is to remember that in the Northern Rockies, encounters with the environment remade Shakespeare into a different kind of a book. So now, onto some stages. That's easy to do, considering that all the world's a stage, or so someone once said. As the gold rush hit Montana Territory and cities like Virginia City were built, they quickly established structures that reflected those two books that pioneers were carrying across the frontier, the King James Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. Shortly after its founding in 1864 in Virginia City, there was quickly built a church and then a theater. By all accounts, the theaters in Virginia City were not comfortable places. They were leaky, the benches were rough, it was very, very cold in there. Nonetheless, the citizens of Virginia City were hungry for any kind of theater. Vaudeville, melodrama, it didn't matter. But what they really wanted was Shakespeare. They had this opportunity when Jack Langrish, a well-known itinerant actor, and his troupe came up from Colorado. Do any of you know that series Deadwood from a few years ago about Deadwood, South Dakota? Jack Langrish is a character in that series. Now, as Langrish and his troupe were traveling en route to Montana, they stopped one day and let the horses rest, and they were taking a break for food, and it just so happened that they saw a skull on the ground, the skull of a man, perfectly formed, teeth intact. So the property manager of Langrish's company did what I would have done. He picked it up and said, "This is perfect. We're going to use this as a prop for Hamlet." So they took it with them, they entered Virginia City, and in Virginia City they did in fact play Hamlet, Richard III, Othello, and some other plays. The audiences in Virginia City and in other mining camps around Montana absolutely loved Shakespeare. Montana Post, which was Montana's first newspaper, reviewed Shakespeare, talked about all these different productions, followed the actors. The town was alive with the life given to them by Shakespearean actors. Now, the growth and development of Montana theater meant that eventually there were quite nice opera houses built in most towns all around Montana. And that's quite an interesting piece of the story that I've told in my book. Tonight, though, I want to talk a little bit more about unconventional stages and outdoor performances of Shakespeare. Buffalo Bill, the consummate entertainer of the frontier and performer of Western American mythology, loved to envision what it might look like if he, in fact, performed Shakespeare. He was criticized by some for bringing too much lowbrow entertainment to the West, driving out more established highbrow acts such as Edwin Booth, the most famous Shakespearean actor of his day, and yes, the brother of John Wilkes Booth. Not surprisingly, Buffalo Bill was not deterred by such criticism. He said he would be happy to perform Shakespeare. He said, "I could do Hamlet in a buckskin suit. And when my father's ghost appears, doomed for a certain time, I shall say to Jack, 'Rope the cuss in, Jack.' As Richard III, I shall fight with pistols and hunting knives. In Romeo and Juliet, I shall put a half-breed squaw on the balcony and make various other interpretations of Shakespeare's words to suit myself." Buffalo Bill was a master of blurring lines between fantasy and reality, of using the icons of the West in a self-referential manner. He certainly knew that Shakespeare was adaptable in this way as well, and could also speak to the American West. Cody's spontaneous outdoor arenas gave the impression that all the West was a stage, if only the actors would dare to strut and fret upon it. Now, we usually associate the construction of Western American identity with masculinity, and rightly so. However, in something that happened with an itinerant solo female actor, we can see an interesting parallel story. The name of this woman was Laura Agnes Honey Stevenson, or maybe it was Laura Honey Agnes Stevenson. You get different accounts from different people. She traveled around the West doing a one-woman rendition of the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet. Now, you might wonder, how can one do a one-woman rendition of a scene like this? Well, in the absence of an actor to play Romeo, she simply got a mannequin from a gents' clothing store, dressed it up, robe, hat, and the works, and she set it there on the stage, and then she performed all of her lines to this dummy Romeo. The miners absolutely loved this burlesque show that was interspersed with a lot of singing and piano playing as well. They called her Julio and said they loved it when she made love to Rummy in a high fashion. One night, the miners of the placer camp called Pioneer near Deer Lodge got a little rowdy. They took Rummy with them to the bar after the show, and they forced him to carouse with them all night long. It didn't go well for Rummy. His nose got bitten off, his eyes were gouged out, he was tattered. The next morning, the miners sheepishly presented Rummy to Julio, who wept and wailed and spontaneously performed a histrionic performance that was so impressive that the miners took up a collection and collected more than enough money to replace her most prized prop. Like many of those Bridger stories, the newspapers in the 19th century loved the story, and they kept printing it, reprinting it, and adding to it. Right? There's no way to tell in these stories what really may have happened, but the idea of these stories circulating and compounding into a greater mythology of the American West was certainly at issue here in the story of Laura Honey Stevenson. A much better known actor who traveled to Montana in the late 19th century was Daniel Bandmann. He was born in Germany and had traveled all over the world, not just Europe and North America, but extensively in Asia, before visiting Montana. Now, when he first got to Montana, he wasn't too impressed with the theater conditions. He and his cohort were asked to open John McGuire's opera house in Missoula, but said it wasn't an opera house at all. It was an old livery stable that had been turned into some sort of thespian temple. When the actors descended through trapdoors, they found that, in fact, this was a livery stable because it was built on top of a manure pile. So after using the trapdoor several times, the ghost of Hamlet's father quit after the first night. For Bandmann, though, there was something really interesting about Montana. It had very receptive, interested audiences, and the land of Montana got under Bandman's skin. He decided, in fact, he ought to stop being an actor and instead become a rancher. So he continued to tour for a while as he was trying to close this cattle deal. One day he was in Montreal playing Shylock, as he usually did, and he got a wire that said he'd closed a deal on a ranch in Hellgate Canyon. He said, "I nearly jumped out of my gabardine for joy." So he did relocate to Hellgate Canyon on 320 acres there, where he raised cattle, sheep, chickens, and apples. In fact, random tidbit, he's credited with bringing Macintosh apples to Montana. Now, he was a very popular figure, again, with the newspapers, because he always seemed an eccentric, an outsider. After all, he was a German Jew, he was an outsider, he traveled all over the place, and he had a series of adventures and misadventures on the frontier that also included impregnating a young actress, and there was a bit of a scandal around that. But Bandmann's story was always interwoven with his persona, a Shylock, and all sorts of Shakespearean quotations, which were always laced through every account of his life. Another interesting anecdote about Daniel Bandmann He'd established a toll bridge across the river on his property, and he was really incensed that the Flathead Indians refused to pay the toll. To make matters worse, they were camped out on his land and were taking his chickens and eating them. So, deciding what to do about this, Bandman dressed up in an array of acting garb. A black stovepipe hat, a wig, a waxen mustache, anything he could get his hands on. He came out to the Indians and started shouting to them Shakespearean verse in multiple languages, supplemented by a lot of histrionic gestures. According to the account, the Indians were at first rather perplexed, then truly alarmed, and ran away. Bandman bragged, "Words have saved my kingdom," where the shotgun would have failed. Now, obviously, this particular account is fraught with all sorts of problems about the assumptions underlying the writing of this narrative. This brings me to something I want to say about the research and what I have and have not found in Montana, and that is the unfortunate omission that there is no Shakespearean story when it comes to the Indians in Montana. We have looked in archives and educational records to find some sort of real record about what various indigenous peoples thought about Shakespeare, about their nature of interactions. But as this particular anecdote attests, all we have really are these isolated stories about the Indians being driven off the land and driven off the stages of civilization. Yet even as Montana's white residents refused to engage with its native inhabitants, they were quite insistent about engaging with its land. We might assume that women's reading groups were all about drawing rooms and tea parties and things like that and keeping Shakespeare indoors. This is not actually the case, though. The women of Dillon were out hiking in Sheep Creek Canyon one day when they decided to form a Shakespeare club. When you read the history of this book subsequently, the idea that they were out hiking, that they understood nature, is completely interwoven into their understanding of who they were as women in Montana reading Shakespeare and becoming part of the society. Women's reading groups did perform Shakespeare, sometimes inside, but often the outdoor performances were the most well-known and the most remembered. In 1902, for instance, there was a performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream in Great Falls. The women gathered together, memorized all their parts, and they performed in a field. They arrived on a hay wagon, and one of the women gestured to this field and said, in the words of the play, "Here's a marvelous, convenient place for our rehearsal." They played all of the parts themselves, including the male roles. The one part they didn't play, apparently, was Bottom, which they had played by an actual donkey. I have no idea how that actually worked, but that's what the account says. So the performance was going along really, really well until the heavens opened up and there was suddenly a torrential downpour and everyone had to quickly run away before the wagon got mired in the mud. This was memorialized in a sketch by the cowboy artist Charlie Russell, who happened to be present because his wife was a member of this reading group. So he sketched this bit on the right quickly with this caption, "A Midsummer Night's Dream turns tempest, but all's well that ends well." Russell, known for his iconic paintings of the Western landscape, placed Shakespeare in this space as well. The fairies of Britain were reimagined in a field outside of Great Falls. The forests and heath of Shakespeare's plays had indeed become part of Montana's landscape. Here was the cowboy artist of the West, sketching the event as it unfolded. The reason that we know of this story, other than this sketch, is because the daughter of one of the women who performed wrote about it later for Montana, the magazine of Western history. And indeed, for children, the idea of play, of being outdoors, is especially evocative. Therefore, it's no surprise that various children's Shakespeare groups have also found an important connection to the land. In the 1930s, there was one group of very young children who did a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream in Lake County in the Flathead. They supplemented the flora and fauna of their own backyards these rivers that were flowing through the area where they put the play on by the crepe paper flowers, different things that made this seem familiar, that interacted with the fairy lands of Britain and made them into their own things. This was an interaction, once again, of childhood, of magic with Shakespeare, land, and the natural world. Much more recently, a group of high school students from Belt, Montana, population about 500 outside of Great Falls, has for years been performing Shakespeare's plays annually. In 2017, they had the honor of being asked to come to the world-famous Edinburgh Fringe Festival to do their play there. In Shakespeare's original, the play The Tempest takes place on an island and is about oceans and fairies and the notion of sea change, transforming things into something rich and strange in that sense of magical and mystical. But Belt is very, very far from the ocean. So not surprisingly, the promotional poster for this production doesn't show or attempt to show water, but instead shows this Ariel leaping for joy in a field with mountains in the background. Shakespeare becomes an ocean not of water, but instead of this wheat field. A series of plays put on for Montana Shakespeare in the Park's spring program called Shakes. There's a series of plays that's called All the West's a Stage. I already mentioned that with Buffalo Bill, and it really brings us back to that notion of all the world being a stage. The books and stages I have shown here illustrate the power of improvisation, adaptability, and expansiveness, all qualities that have been shared by Montana and Shakespeare. Now, the process of researching all of these stories has been a story in and of itself. Sometimes I threaten to write the second book, which is about how we found some of these things. Kevin Luke and I have found ourselves in various archives, in Carnegie libraries, in town halls, and in other sites of interest around Montana. 2 years ago, we went to the town of Kendall, a ghost town outside of Lewistown. Kendall was a gold mining town established at the beginning of 20th century. It flourished for a very short time. 20 years after its founding, it was completely uninhabited. But during the time that it did flourish, it ran a regular ad in the newspaper for the bank that read, "There is a bank wherein the wild thyme grows," from Midsummer Night's Dream. "Here is a bank wherein your odd change grows," from the Kendall Miner. In these boom and bust economies, banks are obviously important symbols of people who want to make it rich, who can succeed based on this gold mining boom. At the same time, the engagement of Kendall with Shakespeare was even a little bit more intricate. There was apparently an employee of this bank, a certain teller named Mr. Henderson, who had recently gotten married. It seems to have been a shotgun wedding. And the paper reported that he kept a copy of Taming of the Shrew on his desk, and he was fervently consulting it and perhaps offering some advice to other people in the town. Now, this kind of good-natured banter also shows a familiarity that people had with Shakespeare, a desire to incorporate him into capital, into marriage, and into the entertainments in the gazebo that stood at the center of the town. Right now, of course, this is a ghost town, and it's in ruins. That's what the bank did look like on the upper left, and this is a picture we took of it 2 years ago on the lower left, where you can still see a piece of the vault. As we walked around Kendall and these ruins, it felt like we could almost hear the voices of those people laughing about Shakespeare, about poor Mr. Henderson being saddled with this marriage, about this life that was so short, but also very, very vibrant. And walking around this ghost town, feeling the presence of ghosts, made us once again have that same impulse we have at Poker Jim Butte. We want to be part of the story. We want to be part of the story of Shakespeare in Montana. And looking through some of these ruins, these open windows and all of that also reminded us very much of those ruined castles not far from Shakespeare's hometown where we had been a few years before. This has all reminded me once again that my study of literature has always been founded upon archaeological rubble. This is a romantic story, I suppose, yet one need only look at the hillside above Kendal to realize something much more literally scarring, that is, the scars left by the extraction of the minerals from this gold mining town of Kendal. In recent years, my work on Shakespeare has become more informed by eco-critical approaches, both historical and presentist. That is, what would it mean to put Shakespeare on a stage that could help us talk about our own environment and our own ecological crises? So I'd like to conclude by just explaining really briefly about a new project that I'm working on that is a natural outgrowth of what I've been talking about this evening. This recent project returns me to that first play I ever edited, Timon of Athens, this time, though, set in Montana. In Shakespeare's original play, there's a wealthy man named Timon who throws a series of lavish parties for his friends, showering them with gifts, with horses, with property, anything. But he's ultimately doing all of this on credit. So he spends far beyond his means. When the creditors come asking for the money, Timon foolishly believes that his friends are going to bail him out. They, across the board, refuse to do so. He's so outraged that he leaves Athens, declaring he wants nothing to do with people anymore. He declares himself a misanthrope. He will no longer live in society, but instead be like a beast among the beasts. He's going to live off the land, so he starts digging in the earth to get roots. Ironically, he turns up instead an unexplained treasure of gold. People visit him after this in the wilderness. Some of them want the gold. Some of them want to tell him everything that he's done wrong. Not all of these people are evil, but Timon's not able to distinguish between good and evil in humanity or anything else. He carves his own epitaph and dies cursing humanity. My adaptation is now called Timon of Anaconda. As you might guess, it takes place in Butte. The setting is the late 1960s and the 1970s. It is remarkable how well Shakespeare's play maps onto this particular setting and time period. The boom and bust economy of Butte, the greed of the Anaconda Company, the labor and class struggles, and of course, the environmental degradation wrought by mining. This immersion in Montana's history, though, is not meant merely to replay this sad environmental story with which we are all very much too familiar. Timon, though, believes that he can escape from society, that he doesn't have anything to do with the scarring price of the greed of mining. My adaptation seeks to interrogate the assumptions we all make about our consumption and our implication in degradation that results in things like the Berkeley Pit. As Timon digs for roots in my adaptation, he turns up not gold, but minerals laced with copper deposits. In developing an adaptation and considering Shakespeare's language about beasts, especially dogs, I have found an interesting addition to my adaptation in the form of this dog on the lower right that some of you may have seen before. His name is the Auditor. He lived around the Berkeley Pit for about two decades and was fed by the miners. As you can probably guess from the way he looks and the environment in which he was surviving, he carried around tremendous levels of toxins in his body. At one point, they tested his fur and saw outlandish amounts of arsenic and other toxins. He has subsequently served as a sort of symbol in Butte. Sometimes people think of him as this great symbol of the resiliency of the people of Butte who've been able to survive despite everything that's happened there. But he also, of course, symbolizes the price that we pay for our own greed and the very real condition of our environmental catastrophe. Theater is an inherently communal genre. That's why I love it. It's not just about a playwright, it's about actors and directors and artists who get together and produce something that is much greater than the sum of these parts. And then theater needs the audience to create that generative excitement that I felt when I first saw King Lear in London so long ago. Adapting Shakespeare is, I have found, the ideal way to use the shared power of theater to address the shared concerns of and solutions to our destroyed ecosystems. Stories like minerals are embedded not just in our minds and histories, but in the earth itself, these material places where we have walked, settled, and claimed pieces of land. Shakespeare has been part of Montana for two centuries, integral to our palimpsests, and thus provides material for understanding our histories and futures in this last best place.